Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Dexter Fergie, and you're listening to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Aaron Hiltner, a lecturer at University College London, who published a fascinating book that shakes up a lot of the narratives that we tell ourselves about the Second World War. It's titled Taking Leave, Taking Liberties, American Troops on the World War II Home Front. American historians tend to keep the home front separate from the battlefront, but as Hiltner shows, about 3 out of 4 servicemen in the months leading up to D-Day were stationed domestically, while 1 in 4 never went abroad at all. In other words, a lot of GIs spent a lot of time in the U.S., especially in places like San Francisco, Boston, and other Liberty ports. In these places, catcalling, theft, assaults, rapes, drunkenness, harassment, fistfights, rackets, all of these things were taking place and were, as Hiltner shows, a part of the wartime experience. And so, Aaron, I'm so excited that we're talking about this book. Thanks for coming onto the program.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. I'm really happy to discuss it with you.
Just to begin, I was really struck by your very neat description of the classic GI story, the one about, you know, the young, naive American teenagers going abroad, being exposed to foreign dangers, and then coming back as hardened veterans. I think a really good place to start is with that story. So can you just share with listeners a little bit more about that classic story, you know, what it looks like, and from your perspective, what it gets wrong?
Yeah, I think that's a really great starting point. I'm glad you identified it. Because I think it is the sort of go-to narrative for when people are trying to understand what the war was like for most troops. I think you could take any number of films or books, but maybe the obvious one would be Saving Private Ryan, where we have this collection of mostly grizzled veterans, but we also have our sort of stand-in character, the younger soldier, who's a bit timid and shy throughout, a bit scared of war, but wants to document what's going on and understand it better. And over the course of the film, he grows more and more accustomed to how this group of men interact, the kinds of masculinity that they display, and the nature of war itself. And by the end, he moves from someone very young and naive and even merciful, even sparing a German prisoner, to one who actually kills that prisoner at the end of the film. And I think that story is appealing in a lot of ways because it speaks to the sort of good war idea of a naive, innocent country brutally attacked by the Japanese and then thrust into the position of needing to lead the world and to fight the war and win it. And I think that that narrative is very appealing because it very much presents the U.S. as rightfully ascending to a kind of American century in the Cold War. And it also depicts a kind of moral purity to the cause, seen both in combat, but also the sort of doting family members and civilians at home doing everything they can to support the war. So it's a very unifying picture of the United States that papers over a lot of the conflict that was actually occurring on the home front.
Mm-hmm. Great. And another question that I like to start out with is how my guests arrived at these projects. Like, at which point did you realize that you needed to do a project on U.S. troops stationed in the U.S.?
Yeah, I was originally doing my PhD at Boston University. I was originally interested in doing a project on kind of the urban history of the Vietnam War.
Oh, interesting.
And trying to make an argument that, you know, actually a lot of the most important decisions, events, and thought processes sort of going on are people stationed in urban cities like Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, and that a lot of the urban politics, especially of Diem ascending to power, are forged there. And as much as when you're a graduate student, they tell you, you know, even if there's somebody doing a similar project, I ultimately decided that a book, Cauldron of Resistance, was way too similar to what I was doing. We had both sort of a very, for me at least, felt, oh gosh, we've both arrived independently at the same argument, but this is far too similar. So I needed to switch up my project. And I kind of went back to some of the work I'd done as an undergraduate, thinking about military masculinity and the overall experience of being a soldier, which I had always thought we tended to get wrong a bit in some histories, but also in broader popular culture, because we focus fairly exclusively on the combat soldier. So I was interested in thinking about what's the actual daily experience of a soldier or a sailor like. And then my advisor, Brooke Blower, had also written a fantastic article looking at sort of the longer history of Victory Over Japan Day, specifically focused on New York City and sort of the famous Times Square kiss, where the kissing sailor is leaning over and embracing and kissing a woman in celebration of the end of the war. And unpacking that mythology was a project I was very much interested in, and we sort of set off from there.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. The classic line of about GIs in the Second World War is that they were overpaid, oversexed, and over here. And this is British soldiers complaining about American soldiers stationed in Britain or whatever. Your book is really playing with the here part of that statement. Mm-hmm. You change our focus, or shift our focus away from the theaters of war, which a lot of the soldiers never even went to, and instead focus on the United States, the continental United States, the training bases, the transit stations, the Liberty ports. Can you, just before we get into like the individual chapters and some of the more particular stories, can you just give a sense of the number of soldiers who were in the U.S. And just how long they would have been spending, before they would have been deployed overseas, or can you just give us a better sense of that?
Yeah, of course. I'd have to look at the book again, but I believe over 16 million serve throughout the entire war, and up until preparations for D-Day accelerate in the spring of 1944, about 65 to 75% fluctuates a little bit, are based within the U.S. And troops went through a number of different stages before they actually might leave the U.S. Of course, 25%, I think, as you said in your introduction, never do leave the U.S. because you need a lot of administrative support for those combat soldiers. This is what we call the tooth to tail ratio. There's much bigger tail in the U.S. military than there is teeth. And these are people supporting logistics, supplies, medicine, cooking, transportation. These are the main things that most people in the military did, especially in the army. And so they would go through a number of stages before they, let's say that they actually leave. They're going to go to their registration and induction camp. They'll go through basic training. They might go through a specialist camp. And then they're going to be shuttled throughout the U.S. They might go on to do different kinds of training. They might be employed in different labor practices. Some are used as longshoremen, for instance, and they go between different port cities depending on where they're needed. But in acceleration before they're going to actually leave to go overseas, they would certainly go through a Liberty port and be there for, in some cases, up to a month or two, with a lot of time for leave and furlough, meaning they were going out into the city. And on any given night in New York City, for instance, you might have tens of thousands or even over 100,000 troops surging into the city. And very often, it's not like they're evenly distributed, of course. They're tending to go to the same places. Times Square and Coney Island are two of the favorites. So it's a very concentrated mass of troops in these places, which, of course, creates real issues in terms of overcrowding, policing, and a number of other issues that we can talk about.
Mm-hmm. And so just moving on a little bit, something that I really like about your book is that it focuses on like structural reasons, or there are structural explanations for, you know, why GIs behaved the way they did. And one way that you do that is you think about the like organization of the army at the beginning of the Second World War, and thinking about how the army, the military made certain choices that built up this almost like anti-civilian, like hyper-masculine culture. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So I think the military experiments with a number of different approaches to building up, you know, esprit de corps and discipline. These are the two major concepts that Marshall, the chief of staff, talks about in a number of different documents. But other planners, even throughout the Navy, are concerned with the very same thing about how do we get all these citizens, right, into a more soldiering mindset. And the original thing that they focus on is kind of a more older model of esprit de corps, going back to World War I, but frankly, even, and it seems silly to say, but almost to the Napoleonic era, right, of, you know, like serving the state and fighting for patriotism and country, you know, and all those sort of very grand ideals. And it just doesn't work. I mean, I think within their own archival materials within the National Archives and in regional National Archives, again and again, they talk about the failures to achieve this. I think the readers can find this as a digital resource, but, you know, in Time and Life magazines, you know, at this period, you know, soldiers are openly questioning FDR, the war effort. They talk about where they're serving as this goddamn hole. You know, it's not shaded in all in their disdain, especially pre-Pearl Harbor, for any kind of military service. But even after the boost in morale that we see after Pearl Harbor, problems with discipline, troops failing to salute officers, getting into brawls with officers, you know, abandoning their posts in large numbers continue. And so the military eventually decides that this more kind of organic barracks culture, which begins to identify civilians as soft and being a civilian as being akin to being emasculated, is a more powerful force for organizing their men, and drawing an opposition line between civilian identity and soldiering identity is what becomes the greater and greater focus of military indoctrination and training during this period. And it's important, I think, as we're talking about this, because I think my book tries to make some real criticisms of military policy and the way troops acted at times. But it's important to keep in mind just how poorly a lot of the training and mobilization process was done, how little infrastructure there were. Men are often arriving to completely barren camps. Literally, you can just see like the dust flinging through the air as they arrive off the buses. They're, you know, like their accommodations are completely, you know, ramshackle. They're burning, you know, wood smoke inside these barracks in just a horrible way. It's a really not pleasant place to be training. And most of the instructors, especially in the early stages of the war, really don't know what they're doing because they don't have combat experience. And so it's a really tough place to be. And in that hardship, you need to find some way, I think, to legitimize what you're doing. And more men turn to this idea that to be soldierly was to be kind of a very heterosexual, very virile, very aggressive, swaggering. And all these qualities are going to be things that leaders like, you know, Patton very famously were going to support as the means of getting men ready for war.
Mm-hmm. One story that I think highlights a lot of this is the so-called Yoo-hoo affair. Do you want to just share with listeners what the incident was and what the fallout was from that?
Yeah. So there were a few troops who were out and about, and they saw some women, young women, and they essentially started Yoo-hooing or catcalling at them. And they were near a golf course as this was taking place. And just so happened to be at that time, there was a General Lear, who saw his own men, you know, behaving in this way. Lear is, I think, a very old school sort of officer and regarded this as a real affront to the conduct of how you're supposed to be in uniform, according to Lear's vision of soldiering. And so he went over to them and began, you know, cussing them out, basically telling them to fall in line, not, you know, do what they were doing. Unfortunately for the men, Lear was not wearing his general's uniform, but he was, in fact, dressed like a sort of elderly golfer. And they sort of brushed him off in a very unbecoming way. So Lear later got his uniform, found the men, and punished them fairly severely by making them on these very long runs in extreme heat. Some of the men got sick. And this basically boiled over into a somewhat important national news story. All the papers reported on it. And basically the consensus was that, you know, there's nothing really wrong with some boys, you know, exercising their good manly virtue by yoo-hooing at some women, was the press consensus. And certainly the consensus within the Senate was even more harsh towards Lear. Some senators, you know, basically tried to prevent his later promotion, said that he, you know, had absolutely, you know, treated these soldiers in a most horrible way, and that he effectively needed to be punished for doing so. They would punish him later by continuing to prevent his promotion. And so the set a precedent, I think, early on, that anyone trying to prevent troops from, you know, behaving more acceptably in public and not catcalling or wolf whistling after women or pursuing women in that way was going to be punished. And this stuck with Lear throughout his entire career. When he finally got back from Europe once the war ended, as he got off the boat, you know, the swarm of troops and sailors gave him a big yoo-hoo as he got off the boat. So it's something that very much endured throughout his career.
Mm-hmm. And what I find really fascinating about that story is how the anti-civilian or anti-woman culture within the military was also something that was consented to by at least a pretty big portion of the public, you know, in terms of the press and the politicians. And so, yeah, this like this divide between the military identity and the civilian identity was something that was like being built up by both sides. So something that I found really interesting, another thing that I found really interesting, sorry, there are just a lot of things in this book that I found interesting, is your point about how us historians of the U.S., we like to think of, or we think it's important to think about how the U.S. military exercises legal power over foreign places and foreign people, and how this is actually really critical for, you know, understanding like the extension of U.S. power, the extension of U.S. empire. And you make an analogy between this form of legal power and the various legal powers that the military got for itself during the Second World War over civilians in the U.S. Soldiers were insulated from, various rules and regulations. They got all these certain privileges that civilians didn't get. Can you talk about this, this analogy and maybe some of those privileges that soldiers got?
Sure. And I think, you know, as a starting point, it is important to acknowledge that, you know, civilians in other countries had a harder time than U.S. civilians, right? So if you were a civilian in Normandy during the invasion, this is partly what Mary Lou Roberts looks at in What Soldiers Do. Ruth Lawler also has some really mm-hmm. great emerging work on this as well. And Zach Fredman has a great, great work as well on U.S. troops' treatment of civilians in China during World War II. Mm. So they all make, I think, really good points about how, in a lot of ways, it was worse in these overseas areas. But I think the critical thing is that there's a lot more linkages than there are dissimilarities. And one of those dissimilarities, as I think you're rightly pointing to here, is the extra legal and extraterritorial, in a sense, rights that that sailors and soldiers were afforded by the Army and the Navy. And what I mean by this in many ways is that if you commit almost any level of crime, excluding a few, I think murder and arson were some of those common ones, you're not going to be punished by a civilian court. The established Articles of War, which are the legal precedents guiding the Army, and then Rocks and Shoals, as it's commonly called in the Navy, both establish basically that if a soldier or sailor is arrested for an offense, even if it's a civil offense, they need to be turned over to military authorities. Civilian authorities have no right to hold troops, even in the U.S., even if they've committed a civil offense. And this privilege is really important because it excuses many of the kind of behaviors that troops are engaging in while they're in U.S. ports, like, you know, again, New York City, San Francisco, L.A., San Diego, Boston. And in doing so, they very much mirror the same sort of experiences that other Americans in earlier stages of U.S. empire, you know, had, of having that kind of ability to only be tried by American courts if they committed an offense while they're in a foreign country. And U.S. troops use this, and officers use this in many ways, to excuse all kinds of criminal behaviors that troops are engaging in while on leave and liberty. I think it even goes farther, too, because the Army and Navy are also trying to apply some of their legal precedents to civilian workers working on Navy ships, for example, or in Army and Navy controlled munitions, stockpiles and factories and things like that. So there's even attempts at some points to apply military courts, you know, court martials to people not even in uniform. So I think it shows the very expansive nature of the military's legal purview during this period, not just abroad, but also within the continental U.S.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just a really basic question, can you tell us what soldiers would do on leave? Like, you know, their furlough was something that was, really important, something they look forward to. Like, you know, so what do soldiers do?
Yeah. So in the book, I try to identify three sort of major activities that they'll engage in. One of those is drinking. One of those is brawling, and one of those is sex. Now, did all troops, commit a sexual assault? You know, of course not. But it was a very common sort of thing to experience and see on these nights where Leave and Liberty is taking place. Like a standard description that you'll see over and over again in soldier and sailor memoirs is that the leave point approaches in the day. The men start to leave the ships near either the port or dockyards that they're stationed at or the railroad station that they've come in on. They start getting, as they would say, liquored up. And they found all kinds of ways to find alcohol, including at one point distilling torpedo fuel.
Oh my gosh.
they find a way to take torpedo fuel and actually distill it into alcohol. So that's kind of like the first stage of the night. Going out then, getting increasingly drunk, maybe finding a civilian to brawl with. One of the terms used in this period is 4F, which is a draft class designation, i.e. meaning someone who is not going to be drafted for any number of reasons, but it's more often associated with, people who object to being it or are physically handicapped in some way. That's not the full gamut of why someone might be designated 4F, but it becomes a pejorative term for male civilians who are kind of unworthy or unfit to wear the uniform. So they would be targeted, men not in uniform. But they would also very often brawl with civilian police or even their own police forces, military police and shore patrol. There are, really countless records going through stuff in the National Archives and the regional archives of men beating up shore patrol officers or reaching for their guns and things like that. So there was a real disdain for police officials throughout this period that could happen on any given night, really. And then the other element is trying to find women, either in a romantic way, but also, and too often, as I try to capture in the book, in a very coercive way. So for many white heterosexual troops, these are the ones who are going to not really experience any kind of policing oversight. It's a very different story if you're not heterosexual or not white. But for white heterosexual troops, you might start by finding a good, what they called a perch, right? So maybe a place near a subway station in Times Square or near Scully Square in Boston. And there you could kind of leer or wolf whistle, often with a group of other men, and then might pursue or, follow a woman, either try to take her to a bar, or go back to, a place for sex. But also going to bars and things like that was very common. And it all becomes this kind of cacophony, right, of drinking, sex, brawling, coercion that ends, at the end of the night with men being spilled out into the streets. So it was very raucous, very violent, and filled with civil military conflict because many civilians, people who ran the bars, understood that in some ways, right, these men are bringing in huge dollars to these entertainment zones, but they're also a real threat and danger at times to the lives and property of civilians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you even have stories of, like bartenders, getting into fist fights with, soldiers and sailors, sometimes even, like ending in death. So you know, so far we've really focused and foregrounded the experiences of the soldiers and the sailors. In the third chapter, however, you kind of turn the camera towards women and their experiences during wartime, and again you handle this really neatly. The classic, you tell us the classic story, or the classic stories, the classic images of women in wartime, the emancipatory entrance into the workforce, or the bittersweet goodbyes, but you show that like women weren't just working and waiting. Now women had money. So what do they do with the money? There are all these like new opportunities, living near, these like factories. Can you tell us a little bit about, sort of the experiences of, women during, the Second World War?
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting part of trying to untangle the home front experience, because again, you see the kind of very triumphal story that is often, I think, told in popular imagination about the home front as this being, the period of Rosie the Riveter and the mm-hmm. beginnings of maybe a proto wave of feminism and women into the workforce and, economic emancipation, things like that. And of course, historians have done a really good job questioning a lot of those things. But in actually trying to better understand that experience, we've tended, I think, to ignore the very usual presence of soldiers and sailors in their daily lives. It's not just a teary-eyed goodbye at the start of the war and hopefully see you in 1946 or something like that. Instead, troops are moving in and out of the lives of women. And in some ways, there are places where romance did occur, right? There was a lot of wartime marriages. Letter writing was a very important form of boosting morale for troops and for establishing communication between often young couples. Susan Carruthers' book that just came out on Dear John Letters is particularly great in untangling some of this. But I think for a lot of women, the presence of troops could be a far more, use a word I don't like, but complicated, I think actually suits this situation. Because certainly moving into wartime ports afforded far more freedom than they might have previously had. They had real money. Of course, they weren't paid as much as they should have been for the work that they were doing, which was often dangerous in these defense plans. But they really did have quite a bit of disposable income at times. And one of the dynamics that first, appears here is sometimes that the women have more money at that, on the date than the man does. Mm-hmm. And this upsetting of that kind of male breadwinner dynamic that the state was so invested in reinforcing throughout the New Deal and into World War II begins to challenge some of that, heteronormative breadwinner foundation of American economic and political life. And I think that's partly perhaps what drove some of the violence against women by troops especially. But women could also look to troops as a protector. Eleanor Roosevelt, I mean, this is, I think, a sign of how much of a crisis this was in terms of the amount of sexual assault occurring, that Eleanor Roosevelt, explicitly talked about the need for women to find an escort if they're moving through Liberty ports, and that they need to find a reliable man who might be able to ward off attention that they didn't want. So troops could really genuinely offer that and might ward off that kind of aggression. But at the same time, these troops are not going to be there forever. And it's a place where women increasingly are trying to figure out, as I talk about, who are the good men and who are the wolves? Wolves being a term of like a very sexually aggressive or violent, physically violent man. And them trying to figure that out was often very much an individual process where they just had to use their intuition. And of course, that always didn't always work out for them, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this chapter was for me filled with all sorts of really like gobsmacking details, just things that I wouldn't have expected. You know, at one point you talk about these young women who work at a Lockheed factory who almost revolted after some nearby social clubs were closing down because of electricity shortages. And so you really see how like the war was providing all these like really novel freedoms and opportunities to, you know, like for like new forms of socialization. And but then, of course, this came with a real danger. And I think the kissing sailor photograph that you mentioned earlier, I think, is a really good example of this on VJ Day. I think you kind of briefly went through it, but do you want to maybe talk a little bit about, just elaborate on that a bit more?
Yeah, I think it's a photo that, you know, anyone listening to this has almost certainly seen before.
Yeah.
Times Square framed in the background, a sailor leaning down and kissing and embracing this woman. And, you know, I think the common story told about this kind of plays into what we started talking about at the beginning, of almost the returning veteran, hardened and now ready to come back and start a nuclear family. And, you know, to he's fought for his woman and now reclaimed her back, is ready to build post-war America. I think that's some of the mythology baked into this moment of jubilation and celebration. But as, you know, a lot of historians have started to uncover, and Brooke Blower does this really well in her article, which is part of an edited volume, The Familiar Made Strange. What she does really well, I think, in that, and what I try to also add on to here, is that this story is not true. You know, this isn't correct. The sailor who we believe is a guy named George Mendoza, I believe, is someone who was getting drunk throughout the day, who had already been grabbing different women along the street, and found this woman and had grabbed her. And if you look up online, you can actually see the photographer Alfred Eisenstadt's series of photographs. There's a whole series of them, and another photographer took one from another angle as well. And what you can see in those photographs is that, in fact, this is not like a jubilant celebration of a mutual kiss. This is a woman who's just been grabbed. You know, he's been grabbing at her clothing, pulling her, and very much like pushing and pulling her in. And it's a real moment of, you know, sexual assault and coercion. And that kind of forced kissing was a real hallmark of VJ Day, not just in New York City where this photo took place, but in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, of women being forced to kiss soldiers and sailors, rapes occurring, you know, on some of the busiest streets in these major cities, and basically nothing being done for the women who were assaulted. You know, nothing was ever really done by Army Navy boards or by the civilian police.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's so striking because like that is, you know, like one of the images, one of the like the real symbols of the war and the end of war. Like it's so clearly a fiction. And that kind of takes me to another question that I had, which is, you know, the stories that you're giving us, you know, paint a very different picture of, you know, of what GIs were doing during the Second World War, the you know, civil military relations during the war, you know, these, like what you're presenting really deviates from the the common story that we tell about the Second World War. You're also suggesting that these weren't just like one-offs. This was structural. The assaults, the rapes, the the riots, all of this debauchery, like all of this was actually pretty widespread. That being the case, how do you explain the continued mythology of the good war, of the soldiers as heroes? It's something that I was thinking about throughout your book.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating element, especially because of some of the reactions I got as I developed the research and when I published the book, is that I think a lot of ways the people who were most positive toward the book were actually veterans, and who appreciated that I at least tried to understand what actual military experience was like. And the interesting thing is, I think this extends beyond World War II, that carousing with your friends and essentially, being a kind of a swaggering man in front of your friends is a hallmark of military identity and a way to mark you in through these almost shared rituals of masculinity. And it's a good question about like why these have been edited out, because they're just everywhere. It's one of those things that I would say the history is hiding in plain sight. It speaks to the way we've tried to edit out how the military is allocated what it called at the time spoils of war, right? Access to women, access to sex, access to booze, and ways of blowing off steam that took place in, as I said before, China, Australia, the Philippines, the UK, but also the US. And I think there's a lot of reasons why that history has been buried from our memories. One of those, of course, is to make the experience of military service synonymous with, landing on a beach in D-Day or going onto a Pacific atoll and, fighting it out with the Japanese, because it's a way of valorizing service in a nation, especially since, of course, it's the 1970s, that has been an all-volunteer force. And that kind of celebration of service is a key way for U.S. empire and U.S. military to continue doing what it does while civilians at home feel good about what that experience is. If all soldiers are basically combat soldiers and they'll put themselves in harm's way in some way, we can excuse some of the spoils of war that are taken, to put it euphemistically. So I think that that's one element of it. But the other is maybe not a revolutionary point by any means, but World War II is a point of moral clarity in U.S. history that is hard to find elsewhere, I think, for a lot of contemporary people. You have the Japanese and Nazi Germany. It's just so clear in popular histories and films and books about, in video games, I would add, right, about who are, who's in the moral right here. And so adding in this story that actually not that many troops were engaged in combat and their actual experience of learning a kind of military identity might have been, getting really drunk in Boston and smashing up a bar, isn't the heroic story, and I can understand that people aren't necessarily champing at the bit to abandon that heroic story because it's a very comforting one. But I think it's also one that very much doesn't try to understand the actual experiences of troops, which is, I think, fundamentally what I was starting at. But it's also one that ignores the reality of what mobilization and war look like.
I think that parallels with the common understanding of like what war actually looks like, you know, on the receiving end. Americans tend to overlook what, you know, like a military intervention would actually look like, you know, in various foreign and far-flung locales. And so, yeah, so I mean, I think it's a very central part of the American way in the world, this sort of like strangely close but always obscuring relationship with war, you know, whether it's abroad or at home. I think that your book just does such a fantastic job of, starting to do some of the dismantling of those mythologies. So something else that I would love to talk to you about is sort of the broader subfield of, you know, that, in which your book is located. And so that's like what I like to think of as the domestic history of U.S. foreign relations. This is something that historians like Kristen Hoganson, you know, yourself, Brick Blower are all thinking about. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, you know, on this subfield, why you think it's something that historians of U.S. foreign relations should think about?
Yeah, I think that's a really great way to frame it. You know, to me, it's a field that is really burgeoning with some of the most exciting research, because it's such a novel way, I think, within our own historiographies, but also within our courses and modules, of helping people understand where those connections are. Because the sort of isolationist myth of U.S. foreign relations has been something that I think is still very much present in the minds of the public, visioning that that throughout most of its history, the U.S. was isolationist, and really only in this, you know, moment of 1941 does the U.S. begin to become truly engaged with the world. I think that myth has been quite pernicious preventing us from seeing those transnational connections, right, between U.S. foreign relations and what's taking place domestically, and how often there are similarities between what's going on in Sydney, Manila, you know, San Francisco, and London. And so I think that's one of the crucial points that I was initially trying with the book. And then I think for, you know, even for historians, we sometimes, we maybe sometimes lazily still accept this notion of isolationism in U.S. foreign policy, and draw a very distinct line, right, between these two sectors of our histories and how we teach them. And I hope what the emerging field can really do is show those broader connections. I think even within the public, you know, a book like, you know, Daniel Immerwahr's How to Hide an Empire has begun to argue, right, for a greater connection between empire and the domestic U.S. in its own way. I'm not going to go into all the debates about that book that Paul Kramer engaged in, of course, but I think that it's a really interesting way, especially for our students, to understand exactly how empire is manifested in different ways, and how the U.S. public itself has more and more experiences of that. And, you know, I think about that even today with the nature of policing in the United States and how many policing tactics are taken from abroad and from our wars and used at home. And so I think this is something that's important for us in terms of our practice of history, but also thinking about contemporary politics today.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really well put. And just to round out our conversation, I would love to hear more about what you're working on right now.
Yeah, thanks. So I've kind of gone in a different time period, but I'm still trying to understand some classic American figures. So I think this book, I'm trying to understand the soldier. My next project, I want to try to better understand the cowboy. And so with this project, I'm very much interested in cowboys and ranch managers going abroad to places like Brazil, Argentina, Southern Africa, Australasia, to expand American beef markets. And this is taking place from the late 1800s into the 1960s, and trying to track kind of the ecological imperialism that both American and British cowboys and ranchers, I think this is a small digression, but, you know, many of the most famous like American cowboys and ranchers weren't born in the U.S. A lot of them are Scottish, actually. Right?
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So there's a whole history of kind of the cowboys of the Highlands, as they have sometimes described themselves. So I'm looking into that larger history that is a transnational history, but also tackles the histories of empire, capitalism, and ecology. Today, I've just, this point is brought up in an article I just published for, into the Stacks essay that I published for Modern American History. But today, you know, the beef industry and the dairy industry combined, so just beef and dairy, produce more emissions than the entire European Union. So it's a massively important, you know, in terms of ecology and what our climate is going to look like, industry that, you know, outpaces, you know, this huge region of the world. Yeah. And that system of creating a meat and dairy system, building it in countries like Argentina and Brazil, was in many ways directly set up and influenced by these American cowboys and ranchers and British cowboys and ranchers trying to seize control of beef export markets at the turn of the century. So I'm diving more and more and more to, you know, the history of beef and ecology and empire.
That sounds like a fantastic project. I'll be really excited to see what you do with it. Aaron, again, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has been a terrific conversation, really eye-opening. You've uncovered such gobsmacking material about World War II. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dexter. I really enjoyed this.
And I'm Dexter Fergie, and you've been listening to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I've been speaking with Aaron Hiltner about his book, Taking Leave, Taking Liberties, American Troops on the World War II Home Front. It was published in 2020. I highly recommend that you go and get a copy. Okay, take care.